This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, a scathing review of plans to change Bougainville's mining laws that include amendments that hand 40% of mineral rights to an Australian mining company. And debates being reignited over Australia's climate policies, with the opposition saying that a lack of action is undermining the government's so-called Pacific step up. And New Zealand's Foreign Minister too is asking questions.
What we do want is to have an explanation from countries as to why they signed up in Paris to that accord and haven't given it the flesh back home to back up their signature. What were they signing up to?
You know, we respect countries' sovereignty and the decisions that they make, but climate change is the issue that requires a global response.
That is Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa. We're also going to hear more from her as well later in the program. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, to Papua New Guinea, where the Governor of Manus is calling on Australia to take immediate action to remove the remaining refugees and non-refugees from his province. He says he'll be raising the issue with the country's new Prime Minister, James Marape, and it comes amid an increase in self-harm incidents among the men on the island, as our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reports.
And one person in East Lorongo refused to eat, and four in Hillside.
Six in Hillside.
A small group on Manus Island is documenting an increasing number of self-harm attempts among asylum seekers and refugees.
It is a real tragedy, and it's out of control.
Refugee and author Bruce Buchani is among them.
So far, about 50 people attempt suicide and self-harm in Manus Island and some of them in Port Moresby. So far, five people transferred to Port Moresby. And right now that I'm talking with you, at least eight people are, they're keeping them in isolation.
In the most recent incident, a Somali man had to be briefly hospitalised after setting himself on fire. Additional police are on the island responding to the self-harm incidents. Manus Governor Charlie Benjamin says something needs to be done.
They don't want to be here. In Australia, you have to take responsibility. You just have to move them to wherever you have to move them.
It's been almost 6 years since the asylum seekers were first brought to Manus. Some refugees have been resettled in the US, but the Australian government says those who aren't accepted will have to remain in PNG. Mr. Benjamin says he thought the men would have all been processed and moved on by now.
Unfortunately, that is not what is happening. And unfortunately also, they also do not want to stay in Papua New Guinea. And that makes it even harder.
He says he wants to see immediate action from the Australian government.
Definitely, I will be raising it with the new Prime Minister, Honourable James Marape. And I'll get him to talk to the Australians.
The Governor says the onus is on Australia.
PNG government can do much. And Manus can do much.
But Mr. Buchani is also appealing to PNG's new Prime Minister.
Hopefully that the new Prime Minister be brave enough and smart to do something, and we expect that.
Australia's Home Affairs Department didn't respond to Governor Charlie Benjamin's comments, but in a statement said it continues to work closely with the governments of PNG and Nauru to ensure transferees are provided with appropriate health and welfare support services. It said the Pacific International Hospital, which provides health care for the men in PNG, has a dedicated mental health care facility.
That is our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting reporting there from Manus Island. We're staying in PNG, where a parliamentary committee has delivered a damning report into proposed changes to the mining laws of Bougainville. There's been a massive public backlash to the government's move, especially from landowners who say it had stripped them of their rights. And now this report agrees with them. It also finds the proposed legislation is poorly drafted, ambiguous and drawn up without any meaningful public consultation, as Liam Fox reports.
The Bougainville government sparked controversy at the start of the year when it announced, out of the blue, that it wanted to rewrite the island's mining laws. It had only enacted its much-lauded Mining Act a few years earlier, but despite that, introduced three bills into Parliament that would amend it and create a new entity that would be given an effective monopoly over the island's mineral rights, including the mothballed Panguna mine. Mining remains an extremely sensitive issue, 30 years after local opposition to the Panguna mine sparked the decade-long bloody civil war known as the Crisis. Amid the vocal opposition to the proposed changes, the bills were referred to the Parliamentary Committee on Legislation, which held consultation sessions around the island. In its final report, the committee said that public feedback was overwhelmingly negative. Here's a sample of some of the comments it received.
We do not want the Mining Act to be amended. We fought and many lives were lost because of mining.
The time is not the right time to reopen any mining.
The government and foreigners are contributing to the sinking of this island. Don't sell the island again.
The committee's own view of the proposed legislation was also highly critical. It said the bills were vague, imprecise and poorly drafted, and didn't even contain a section that spelt out the precise meanings of important terms to avoid ambiguity. The committee agrees with the concerns voiced by customary landowners that the amendments would strip them of rights and entitlements enshrined under the existing Mining Act. Those include fees, annual rents, royalties, levies, and the right to veto any mining activity on their land. The amendments state landowners will receive more benefits than they currently do, but the report notes those benefits are undefined.
There is no detail in the Mining Amendment Bill as to the process to be followed in negotiating and agreeing upon such benefits. In the committee's view, it is not acceptable to have this important detail not spelt out explicitly in the bill.
The committee also questions the central intent of the proposed amendments to create what's called a special Bougainville entity and give it all available mineral rights, an effective monopoly over exploration and mining activity. That entity would be 60% owned by the Bougainville government and landowners. The government has said the remaining 40% would be owned by Australian company Cabalus Mining and its owner, businessman Jeff McGlynn. The committee's report said it was a curious entity to understand and raised concerns over the ownership structure.
The Mining Amendment Bill does not specify how customary landowners would be represented in the 60% shareholding. Without further details, it is not possible to say how such a structure would work in practice as a means of exercising control over the special Bougainville entity.
The report also notes that the bill makes no provision as to how profits from any mining activity would be distributed between landowners and the government. It concludes by recommending that the bills be withdrawn, redrafted following extensive public consultation, and then resubmitted to Parliament.
The issues that all three bills raise are far too profound given the history and future of Bougainville and overwhelming opposition of its people to be rushed.
Pacific Beat has sought comment from Bougainville's president and the mining minister.
That is Liam Fox reporting there. And what happens next with the bills is not clear. Parliament is set to resume this morning, so we will bring you significant updates as we have them. Well, Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister says that Australia has taken a somewhat patronising approach to Samoa over its relationship with China. Fiame Naomi Mata'afa is currently in Australia and she sat down with our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgett to discuss the Australian government's Pacific Step Up program.
Well, Deputy Prime Minister, thanks very much for joining the ABC. We appreciate your time. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Pacific Step Up that the Australian government is pursuing. This is a pretty ambitious agenda here from Canberra. What do you think is driving Australia's desire to engage more intensively in the region?
I think the global political situation and how Australia is viewed from that global perspective, being the larger country in the region, I think it's been asked to play a particular role.
And who do you think's asking us to play that role? Do you think that the US, for example, is asking Australia to step up in something that has perhaps rather patronisingly been regarded by Australian officials as its patch for some time?
Yes, I think so. I mean, that's nothing new. I think that has been the arrangement for quite a long time now. But I think the rise of China and its Belt and Road initiatives is creating, you know, some new dynamic in the global picture.
Now, when it comes to China, in your speech, you accused Australia of taking a slightly patronising attitude towards Samoa's relationship with China. Can you expand on that? In what way has Australia been patronising?
Well, you know, it's in the discourse of, you know, essentially we're being cautioned. We are being warned. We are being told that perhaps we're not fully nuanced on the intentions, I suppose, would be one of the ways of putting it, of the relationship with China. But, you know, Stephen, we've had relations with China since 1975. So it's not a new relationship. And in terms of our development partners, China and to some extent also Japan, or largely Japan, they have been the donor that we've worked with to support especially infrastructure projects. And that's been, you know, in the works for a very long time, not just more recently.
So in your view, then, Samoa is fully capable of dealing with China. What do you regard, then, of these warnings that are sometimes put about by Australian officials and more often by American officials about China's ambitions for debt-trap diplomacy in the region? Do you believe that those claims are a little overinflated?
I mean, I can appreciate where that may happen. And there have been instances, I suppose, where it has happened in the Pacific or looks like it's happening in the Pacific and other parts of the world. But, you know, Stephen, it's part of the lot of governments, you know, whether they be small ones or big ones, that they ultimately make the decisions for the good of their respective countries. It's a bit unfair in that it's not as though Australia or even the United States don't have relations with China. In fact, they have huge relationships with China, especially on the trading side. So in some ways, you know, from the way we look at it, it would suggest that it's all right for them to have relations, but then for us we need to, you know, take the advice from someone else on how we conduct our relationships with other countries.
That is Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mataafa. She was speaking with our reporter Stephen Jedgetts, and we're going to hear more actually about some of those pressures about relationships shortly in the context of Solomon Islands' tussle to recognise China over Taiwan. But first, Australia's opposition says that a lack of action by the national government here on climate change is undermining its so-called step up in the Pacific. Its spokesperson for international development and the Pacific, Pat Conroy, says that the government's unwillingness to reduce carbon emission levels is affecting its foreign policy. And questions have also been raised by New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters about why some countries that have signed international agreements on climate change have not stuck to them, as our Pacific Beat reporter Evan Wasuka reports.
The Pacific was front and centre of Prime Minister Scott Morrison's priorities after winning the national election. His first trip was to Solomon Islands, where he unveiled a $250 million infrastructure funding package as part of his government's so-called Step Up in Pacific Engagement. But in Honiara, Mr. Morrison avoided any mention of climate change, an issue that leaders at last year's Pacific Islands Forum meeting said was the region's number one priority. But Australia's lack of action on climate change at home to reduce carbon emissions has not been missed, even by allies. New Zealand Foreign Minister Winston Peters, who was travelling in the Pacific, raised questions, although he didn't name Australia.
What we do want is to have an explanation from countries as to why they signed up in Paris to that accord and haven't given it the flesh back home to back up their signature. What were they signing up to?
In an interview with Vanuatu's Buzz FM, Mr. Peters said New Zealand's climate change response was based on the Bo Declaration, which was signed at last year's forum meeting.
We hear loud and clear the voice of not panic, but of utmost concern amongst Pacific Islanders as to what's happening in their part of the world. And we've made sure that in our international engagements, we've all the way to the Secretary of the United Nations made it very clear what the Pacific wants. It wants a response befitting the problem we face.
Closer to home, the absence of action on climate change has also drawn fire. The Shadow Minister for International Development and the Pacific, Pat Conroy, tweeted the government's Pacific step-up is being undermined by its refusal to enact policies to stop carbon emission rising and set an appropriate 2030 emissions reduction target. In the region, concerns over Australia's lack of action on climate change has also been raised by Pacific leaders. Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister, Fiame Naomi Matafa, told ABC that climate change needs to be addressed.
You know, Australia is part of our region, and it feels like, you know, it's so important if we're looking at this issue globally that all of us in the Pacific can be aligned in this global effort.
Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister says climate change requires a global response, including Australia.
You know, we respect countries' sovereignty and the decisions that they make, but climate change is the issue that requires a global response. So it's not only from a regional perspective or even national perspectives, but I think the whole world needs to come together on this issue. It is our survival.
That is Samoa's Deputy Prime Minister Fiame Naomi Mataafai, Evan Wasuka reporting. Well, in Solomon Islands, the diplomatic wrangling over the country's support for Taiwan is gathering momentum, as we've heard here on Pacific Beat. And the big question for the new government of Prime Minister Manase Sogavare is, do they stick with the longtime ally that has brought economic benefits to the country, or do they switch their allegiance to China with the promise of even greater benefits under its Belt and Road Trade Initiative? Stephen Jedgetts reports.
A piggery isn't usually a tool of soft power. But this is no normal piggery. It sits in the middle of a neat little farm on the outskirts of Honiara and is one of the flagship development projects run and paid for by the government of Taiwan. The farm provides cut-price piglets to local farmers. And Taiwan's deputy ambassador to Solomon Islands, Oliver Liao, says that's not all.
They have managed to bring quite a variety of vegetables and fruit to Solomon Island.
Solomon Islands is one of six Pacific Island nations which still recognises Taiwan, and Taipei pours millions of dollars into aid programs like this to keep it on board. But Oliver Liao says this peaceful equilibrium is being disrupted.
The PRC has been taking every possible measure to force Taiwan into reunification with them. They are hoping to make Taiwan disappear.
China wants to isolate Taiwan diplomatically, and Beijing-backed businesses have made overtures to the Solomon Islands government. Some MPs are now pressing new Prime Minister Manase Sogavare to ditch Taiwan and embrace China instead. And Mr. Sogavare is weighing the decision carefully.
And we are under a lot of pressure to rethink this relationship.
The tide of history might be against Taiwan. Solomon Islands remains mired in poverty, and former Prime Minister Gordon Darcy Lilo says if Solomon Islands recognises Beijing, then investment might boom.
What is it wrong for this country to consider the opportunities that can come out from a China that is a reform China, and a China that can offer a better economic opportunity?
Others are horrified by the rush. Opposition leader Matthew Wale accuses some MPs of taking a mercenary approach.
There's been no discussion about what are our national interests, what are we trying to achieve, what are we looking for. So we're just looking for more money. At the moment, it seems that's the driving force.
Some fear an influx of Chinese cash would also stoke rampant development, fostering corruption and damaging the environment. And the broader geopolitical arm wrestle between the US and China looms over this debate. The US and Taiwan accused China of lending huge sums to several small island nations before using that debt as leverage. Oliver Liao has a coded warning for Australia.
A strong, independent and sovereign Solomon Island is not only in the interest of Solomon Island itself, but it's also in the interest of other countries such as Australia.
Taiwan faces its own accusations of fostering corruption. Critics say the so-called constituency funds it pays to local MPs are often pocketed by elites or frittered away. Prominent journalist Alfred Sasako believes Honiara is capable of negotiating a better deal with China.
Okay, the loans may be bad, but in exchange for the loan, we got good roads, good airports.
Manasseh Sogavare admits the choice is weighing on him.
And we need help here to help us to make a decision that will not affect the peace.
But in the end, this is a decision Solomon Islands must make for itself.
It's Stephen Jedgett's reporting there. Well, with concerns that there's a growing number of people who are being deported back to Tonga from countries like Australia, New Zealand and the United States after they've committed crimes and served time behind bars, what to do with them has been an ongoing problem. Many have never lived in Tonga, so they know little to nothing about the country and have to adjust to a whole new culture. Now a new foundation's been established to address the issue and it's planning to start a boot camp to help the recent deportees, as Girish Salani reports.
Kevin Va'afo'au left Tonga for the United States with his parents when he was 12. In 2009, he was forced out of the country he grew up in after being convicted of money laundering. Adjusting to a new life thousands of kilometres away wasn't easy.
You know, for me, I used to work for the government. I used to have money. I come to Tonga, it's a challenge to me because I got to start all over again. And I miss my dad, my mom in the United States, and I miss my sister. My whole family's there. I miss that.
His situation, though, has become increasingly common in Tonga. Latu Liava'a was only two when his parents migrated to the U.S. in 1979. He, too, was deported to Tonga in 2009 after being convicted and jailed for attempted murder.
Getting deported back is like getting thrown into an ocean. And you're the fish, and then you got the sharks coming after you, the whales and all that. That's how we felt when we got deported back here to the kingdom. It's coming back to nothing. We have nothing here.
He says he was fortunate to have been housed by relatives in Tonga and soon after arriving, got a job in security. But others are not so lucky and often return to a life of crime. And it's for that reason that Mr. Liava'a and four other deportees from the United States started the Dare to Dream Foundation.
If we don't do nothing now to the youth here in the Kingdom of Tonga, the next 5 years is going to be worse than what it is now.
One of the ideas floated by Latu Liava'a and the others who founded Dare to Dream is a six-month boot camp with training designed to incorporate the values of a Marine Corps, such as discipline and teamwork, while also learning about Tongan culture and receiving spiritual counseling through the church. Dr. Netatua Prescott is the deputy chair of the foundation's board.
The idea is to find a safe place where they could come and learn slowly, assimilate slowly to the culture of the country. And that is taking them through the language, taking them through the culture, taking them through the relationship, the churches they could attend to, where to go to find information, talking to them about the legislation of the country, finding out what they could do for a living.
The foundation is currently working with six young deportees and it believes there are dozens of others across the country in need of help. Dare to Dream President Latu Liava'a hopes to kickstart their boot camps in the coming months.
You know, rehabilitation inmates, bring them to boot camp, breaking them down and tell them there's more better stuff in life. You know, you have the choice to say yes or no.
But before that can happen, the foundation wants to know how many deportees there are in the country. The Tongan government doesn't have a clear record of citizens deported on criminal grounds. Current estimates range from a few hundred to 1,000. So the Dare to Dream Foundation is currently using informal networks to map out a more accurate figure. And there's also the issue of funding. The foundation's essentially operating on donations, but is hoping to get more, especially from countries where Tongans have been deported from.
There is an opportunity there. We need to understand what have been discussed, what has been approved between governments bilaterally between Tonga and these countries. And then we will take it from there.
This is Dr. Netatua Prescott Prescott from the Dare to Dream Foundation, ending that report from Girish Salani. And that is all for Pacific Beats this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company. You have a great day.